Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to another CTC Guest Tennis Talk Show. I'm your host, along with my brilliant and wonderful co-host, Coach Susan Nardi. How are you, Susan?
We are freezing here in East Texas. We go from having 80-degree weather to the next day. It's like 42 degrees, and we've got strong 30-mile-an-hour winds. We are freezing tonight. But we're excited because we had another beautiful day of tennis in the covered courts in Beaumont. So life was wonderful.
I hear you. We expected my wife sitting around here. My wife is back home now talking about, you know, the kids got to sleep with us because we're supposed to have some bad weather. We're supposed to have thunderstorms and bad weather. And I hear you. Well, I want you to be safe. I want you to be safe there. So how's things going? You know, I hear you got your kids. Your kids going in tournaments. How are your kids doing? They're doing good. The players.
They're doing good. They're going real well. So yeah, we were. I was out on the court today with my super champ player, and then we were. She's going to Parisi speed training school. She's getting stronger and faster. You know, we're going to help her. Not only does she have great anticipation skills, but we're going to get her that first. Get her, help her be more efficient, get quicker to the ball. So, you know, we've got that going on. And then there was the, I was working with the green ball, the red balls and orange balls. It was last today, and then I had my green balls later, green balls. So that was fun. So a good day. Good day out on the court. You know, people were happy despite it being so cold.
That sounds good. Now, Susan, I was talking to a guy today, and he was asking me about videotaping and stuff like that. And I was telling him, you know, everybody gets this. I don't understand, you know, to me, the angle to me doesn't matter. But, you know, I want to say it again, and I just the angle doesn't matter. And analyzing this kid, we were sitting with this guy, and he was talking about all these different angles. And I'm sitting up here, the angle just didn't matter. So bored me. And they just couldn't understand why it bored me. And am I wrong? Is something wrong with these people? Am I missing it, or am I actually off my rocker on this one where the angle does matter?
Well, you know what? It's nice to know that I got all the intelligence in the family, and you know, and you got all the good looking genes. But yeah, you're a little bit off your rocker on this one. I mean, the angle does matter because you want to, you know, there's some point in time where you want to see what the hand is doing and the path of the racket, but you also need to see the results on the other end of what the ball is doing. You know, what's the height, spin, speed, depth, direction, what's the depth. You know.
Wait a minute. You mean to tell me that I should be on the other side of the net, and that's a baseline, and I should be filming this little ball coming at me to hit me to see what it's doing? That I should be doing that.
Well, sometimes you want to be behind the person. Sometimes you want to be a sign. You need to have multiple angles so you can really see the effectiveness of what the shot is doing, besides just seeing the technical aspect of the hand on the racket and the angle and all that. You know, when you're videotaping, you actually want to see everything. Now, if you're videotaping to have a player going, you know, for a college coach or something, then you want the camera angle to be like it is for TV. But otherwise than that, now, when I'm watching a video of a stroke, I like to see multiple angles so I really get a better feel in a picture, like I was actually physically there.
So is it better as a coach to see it in slow motion or real time, or where? I mean, is it? I understand the slow motion can help you to help a little, but is it better to see it? Is it? Do you lose a perception of it in slow motion? You know, do you lose something of it by looking at it in slow motion? Because I seem to look at some shots. Sometimes I seem to look at something, and I look at it in slow motion, and I can find the imperfections. But then when I watch it, let it go. The swing is so good and so fluid that the imperfections don't matter because the ending result is just so good that sometimes that watching the video in slow motion and slowing it down can actually hurt the player because trying to make somebody a little bit too perfect or trying to, I mean, I think that video can hurt a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as far as the videotaping aspect, there's some things that I like to see in slow motion and other things I like to see it in full speed. I'm pretty good at seeing it in full speed and being able to look at it and seeing what's going on. You know, it's one of those things. Some of the work that Vic Braden did back in the day where he made the human body stick figures, he did some classic work of Federer and Hennen, where you could see the pull across the body. It was actually some of the most groundbreaking work out there. And with the stick figures and doing it at different speeds, it was really, really cool. So, I mean, you know, there are pros and cons to each. It all depends on what the coach needs and what they're able to see. I do fairly well when it's live action. Maybe I slow it down in my brain. I don't know, but I kind of like seeing it full speed because then I get a better sense. And that's why I do better when they're live and in front of me versus on video. But, again, that's just me, and I'm kind of weird that way. But we all have our own quirks, right, Wes?
You know, I guess, you know, I after listening to you and kind of analyzing, I guess watching and videotaping probably is good for a player, is good for a coach, you know. I guess there is a lot of good to it in the angle that you give, the perspective, because you're looking at different things. I guess it's hard to see if somebody breaks a clean or hard to see if somebody does this. You're only looking at one perspective. And I guess it is very important to understanding what the ball does when it bounces on the other side. You know, what are the results of your technique? I think a lot of times we coaches, we look at the technique, but we don't really look at what is the result of that technique. You know, you might have a technique that I guess looks very good, but the result may not be a good result. The ball may not be the ball that.
Well, look at Courier. Look at Jim Courier, for example. If you just looked at Jim Courier's forehand, I mean, it's not that pretty. I mean, let's face it. You compare that to, like, whether it be Federer's or whether it be Djokovic's forehand, Jim Courier's just is not that gorgeous of a stroke. But yet, how effective is it? It was massively effective.
Very,
I mean,
very.
So, I mean, you know, one of the things that Coach Yvonne taught me, Yvonne Gallup, and I love this phrase, and I think it's an awesome phrase, is everything, you know, is it within a degree of correctness? You know, because I agree, we can get so, so highly technical that we lose sight of the effectiveness. What is the effectiveness? And, you know, one thing that Chuck Tomlin talks about is, you know, when he does the smart targets, is, you know, what happens on the second bounce. You know, when the ball descends and it reflects when it bounces, how effective, what happens, you know, is pushing you back, is it staying low, is it pulling you on? And when you look at all that, you can't sometimes tell that from the stroke itself.
That's
why it's important that, you know, I like to sometimes, you know, if you're right-handed and I'm videotaping your forehand, well, I'll be at the side, and then I'll move the camera, or I'll be holding the camera, and I'll move and be behind you so that I can see a different angle of the stroke, but I'm also seeing what they're doing. Is, you know, and that gives a lot of information data, because maybe there's something that's wrong. Maybe they're making the adjustments because of a body or something with their body, but it also might be their body's adjusting and still compensating, and it's still an effective shot. So why would you change it if it's going to not only damage their play but damage their body? You know, because they've adapted to something else. So I think there's lots of different factors, and I think there's, as Yvonne would say, there's a certain degree of correctness. I really love that phrase from her, and I think we can be over technical sometimes.
I agree with you totally. Well, Susan, I was talking we get close together, we get startable today. Never question about cheating. So I came up with, you know me, I came up with this scenario, and I actually believe this scenario. And I believe that, you know, and I hear a lot of people, I believe Sabonis is a player. He calls fault on all the stuff. When the person hits the ball, hits the net, he calls fault. I hear a lot of people say that that's bad sportsmanship, that's just so ignorant. That to me, Susan, that I would tell my player to do that in a heartbeat. And why I think that is, why is that tick people? Why is somebody calling that a bad sportsmanship? What isn't that part of the, isn't that legally part of the game? What's the difference between the ball, somebody serving a ball, hitting the net? Boom, or somebody serving and going 2 feet out, 4 feet out. It's still a fault. Isn't that legally part of the game, and actually can be a very good strategy. And why would person consider that to be bad sportsmanship? It's a fault. I mean, it's real in the game. It's not a holding up. It's a rule in the game. If you tell players to always call the score out, to always call out, to always, that's a fault. I don't understand.
Well, it's funny because, I mean, you can call it gamesmanship or you can call it taunting or whatever, but there is a classic saying, I can't give away the last name, but there was a classic thing when I was in high school. There are these twin brothers at my rival high school and on the guys' team. Frank and Fred, and they were playing the team GW down in Danville, and they were up in Toronto playing. And the number one player, Billy, was a huge server back in the day. I mean, he pounded 120-mile-an-hour bombs with no food serving like that. I mean, big, tall, lanky guy. And I don't know which one of the twins he was playing. I was there at the match and saw it, and it was kind of funny because years later, Billy and I ended up at Elon together. And the guy kept on calling fault. Okay, now the twin was kind of a, I hate to say it, nerdy kind of looking dude. And wore thick, you know, Coke glasses. And he called fault, and he kept on just annoying Billy. And I'll never forget, Billy jumps over the net, takes the guy's glasses off, punches him right in the nose. I mean, hard. The guy falls down. Billy puts the glasses back on him and walks to the other side. I lost it. I thought it was the funniest thing I'd ever seen. And, I thought it was funny that we played a year later together at Elon. But it was, you know, it's one of those things. I mean, I think, you know, when you do things like that, you know, you got to know your animal across the net from you. I mean, an example today, okay, this is a true example. So I'm out there on the court with my super champ player, and Russell's with me, and you know how Russell is too, and so you know we were kind of being a little bit funny, and I started to taunt my girl a little bit, and we were making a run, we were doing a 2-on-1 drill, and then you know I was like making a run, and then I dropped the ball, and I was like going, you know it, and then all of a sudden, I think like 2 or 3 balls later, she literally put the ball in my face. You know, the ball was well going over. Gina Kraft took well over 100 balls an hour. So, you know, you pay a price if you talk. You know, and you can pay a big price. I mean, you know, I'm lucky I still have my face tonight because I was worried there for about 2 or 3 seconds that I wasn't going to have much of a face tonight and the ability to speak. But because it was coming right from my nose and my mouth. But it's one of those things. I think, you know, I mean, you know, look at all what Muhammad Ali to do when he's the box. I mean, he talks to people all the time. I think it's one of those things that, I mean, do people do it? Yes. Is it always a great thing to do? No. I mean, my way of taunting people when I was a player, and I'll admit that I taunted people, is I didn't say out, I said no, because I was being passively aggressive and trying to beat up on your self-esteem. So I wouldn't call the ball out and go, no, no. And I would do that, and that was my passively aggressive way. And that, luckily for me, that never got me in trouble. And I think the only stupid thing I've probably done on the court in the past 20 years is taunt this girl to the right of me. And I nearly paid a huge price with my face today. So lesson is not to taunt the girl to my right. So
I would think, honestly, from my experience, it's concerning thing that a focused player, a player who is focused, especially with the first serve, wouldn't actually hear it. I would just take myself. I wouldn't actually hear you say fault because I would have already known it was fault, and I would have already let that point go, and I would have already been focused so much on the next serve. Well, what you said really doesn't matter because it's about what my intent is. So I would think that a person who allowed that to get to them is still caught up into the fault. I would agree with that.
And, you know, thankfully, I had some good sports psychologists between my junior and senior year in high school. You know, I worked when I was down at Vandermeer's. I had worked with Dr. Bryce Young. I had worked with Bob Rotella at UVA. So that kind of helped me learn how to hyper-focus. But before that, yeah, and I think that's one of the things that's missing in this world is that with kids, and, you know, they're growing, their bodies are growing, they're maturing, they're not, you know, there's a lot to your body, with your body and all that, thinking that you know more than what you know. But I think having somebody that's a good sports psychologist or being very aware of that and how to make you mentally stronger was a huge, huge deal with me. So, yeah.
Good. Well, seriously, you know, we have a coaches contest going on because our good friend Frank, Paulo sent us autographed copies of his latest book, The Tennis Parents Bible, Second Edition. And I swear this book is amazing. And we've got a contest going on for coaches. And I think I've got the perfect question, an essay, Christian, for coaches. And I want to throw it by you. I think that a perfect question for coaches now to win autographed copies of Frank's book is, if we relate the topic to curing performance anxiety, how does a player or how do we cure performance anxiety? Because something we all have, something coaches have to deal with their kids, every kid, I don't care who it is, whether that was Federer, Agassi, we all have a performance anxiety. How do we cure this and to go on to be great players and to have players master this? You know, you know, people don't relate to, even a performance can go when a kid is in the playground and he gets challenged to do a race, and the kid who's not hurt sits there and says, oh, my leg is hurt. How do they cure that? Because he's scared or he has an anxiety about performing. How do we cure performance anxiety? That is a topic that our coaches will write their papers or write their posts or submit their entry on for autographed copies of Frank's Tennis Bibles. And we're going to throw in, if we got a good one, if a post can get 100, like anybody can come up with a post on that, on curing performance anxiety with 100 likes, we'll throw in Raising an Athletic Royalty. That's Frank's another book.
That book is amazing. I tell you, every coach needs to get their parents. I mean, they need to read both books, okay, no doubt about it. But that Raising Athletic Royalty, I make sure that my Red Ball parents have that book, and my kids at the Red Ball and the older sisters at Orange Ball Point, they were reading it, and I had the parents. I said, you're going to make, you know, here, print out two copies of it here, highlight it, the things that resonate with you, and they were just like going, you know, when you're in at the hospital and you're delivering babies, they should hand you this book. Because it tells you every, yeah, and that's what the mom was telling me, that when you come out of the hospital with your baby, they need to hand you this book. And I was like, she's like, I think I highlighted the whole darn thing. I mean, it's one of those things that I can't say enough that every parent, I mean, they need both books, but holy cow. I mean, what a, you know, that's just, and they need to read it, and then they need to reread it. And then they need to reread it again. So, I mean, they're great books, but I think that's a great essay question. And, I mean, that's almost nearly how I lost my face today is, and I know my player so well that she needs to be just slightly annoyed, and then she hyper-focuses as well. So me kind of teasing her a little bit, got her a hyper-focus, and then she's hitting the crud out of the ball. But, you know, nearly knocked my face off, so... But she took the number one player at Lamar, when was it, Monday? Yeah, Monday. And she lost to her in a set, but she won the super tiebreak off of her because they played a super tiebreak. And so, you know, to be 16, you know, to be a 16-year-old player and to push the girl that's only 2 years outside of college, still probably would play one or two at Lamar and take her to the brink like that is a good thing. So, you know, but it's handling, how do you perform when the expectation is to win versus the expectation is just to compete.
Yes, and that's a big thing. I mean, I've even find myself as I gain more knowledge and I become more into coaching, more into things where I used to be winning is everything. And Susan, winning is everything to me. I mean, winning is hope. Winning is joy. Winning is chance. Winning is everything. But I've also learned that maybe I don't mean the result. I don't mean the result of winning it is everything. But before that winning, the winning effort is what's most important to me. And I've learned these things that the winning effort comes from now looking at your intent. Well, now when I find myself now when I speak to my kids, I talk to my kids, I talk to them more of a what is your intent? Forget what the result was. What is your intent? You know, I had a player who's very, very good, and she's good playing good people, meaning she's good. But she's a player. So now she plays high school, and in high school you may play kids who are not as good, and kids are not as good. She struggles again. She tells me, Coach, I can't play with these kids. Why? Because she's used to hitting the ball every 2 seconds, every 2.5 seconds, where these kids don't hit her pace. And I finally got her to understand that one of the reasons why kids struggle with kids who are not as good because you're not playing for intent. If you're playing for intent, you're not worried about who's on the other side of the court. Why? Because you're worried about yourself, what you're intending to do. You're in control of yourself. You control what you can do. And your intent is what you can control. As soon as you start, she's worried about what I would have said before, winning. You know, winning is everything. She wasn't worried about the intent, and she's worried about winning. And once you start doing that, you start playing the opponent, which now becomes – it can become fatal sometime, and I finally got an understanding that that's how you beat pushers. That's how you beat a lot of players who are maybe less than you is playing by intent.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and it's funny because everybody always wants to play up. And one of the things that I learned back in the day was I played a third of the time up. I played a third of the time the people that were my level, and I played a third of the time people that were below my level so that I was comfortable playing them and knew how to handle it, that it wasn't the player, that I'm just playing the ball and playing what I want to do with the ball. I looked at it as like a mathematical word problem. Okay, What can you do well? What do you don't do well? How does it? How does my game fit into that? How am I going to attack it? You know, I play the ball. You know, I get the variables and play the ball, and that's you know what they taught me. It's sort of like when you play basketball. You know, how do you attack the goal when you're playing a man to man? Team playing you man to man defense, or how do you play it when it's the zone? You know. I mean, you know, there's definitely different ways in which you play two different scenarios. So that's one of those things. I think it's a very critical element that we teach players not to look across the net, but to play the ball and to go out there and play the ball. And I look to play everybody and beat them 0-0. I mean, that's always the goal. I hate to say it like that. It makes me sound so bad when I say it, but it's go out and destroy you.
But that's the game. I mean, that's the game. That's the game. But as we talk about this, intent, and as we talk about this plan, Susan, how can a parent who goes to these tournaments, you got all the kids' tournaments, because as much as us coaches say we go to all the tournaments, we don't go to all the tournaments. We can't go to all the tournaments if we have more than two or three kids. We can't go to all the tournaments. But usually at a certain age, the parents are at all of these tournaments, especially at that 12 to 16, even the 18 range. What can a parent do to help that child, exactly what we've talked about, intent? What data can a parent do to give to a coach that can help improve that intent? What is there charting that a parent can do?
I believe that parents should be charting. And I mean, I think not only should they be charting the match, but I also, especially if there's two parents there, I think one parent should be charting the match. I think the other parent should be charting the intangibles, you know, and charting the intangibles of how was their body language, how was their attitude? How was, you know, and those kind of things. And the other one's charting the nuts and bolts. But it's one thing that they charted but did not discuss it, you know, just let the coach discuss it and run the numbers and do that kind of stuff. I think it would probably be better for the parent-child relationship not to go there and discuss what they do when they start starting, but I think it's critical. My dad and my mom both used to chart me a lot. And matter of fact, I still believe in it that my extra players in high school tennis would actually chart matches for me, and I have to schedule out, and I had some that were singles that were charting and some that were doubles, and have them chart what's going on. And I got some good information, and it gave me information that I could adjust practices accordingly. And that's why I think one of the reasons why we thrive.
Well, what information is good information? I understand serve. Okay, I can understand tracking the serve. I can understand tracking the serve. But if I'm tracking as a parent, what am I tracking? Every shot, where he hit it from? Did he hit a forehand from deep left corner? Did he hit it deep right corner? What is good information? I mean, everything is not good information, and sometimes information can be deceiving. What is good information?
You know, it all depends on what the coach is looking for, and the coach should have you know, whatever charting system he wants, whether it's he's wanting to charting something specific or the whole match. And, you know, it takes time. You know, you've got to chart a couple of times before you get it right and before you understand. Don't get overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff. But there's some really good charting things out there. I know we use one that Russell has that's extraordinarily good. I know Frank Giampaolo has one that he does. Dave Smith has one. Alec Horton. I can think of a lot of people that probably have some really good charting stuff out there, and probably a ton more that if folks would actually probably go out and message these people, they could probably get. So that would be my recommendation.
Okay. So So charting does have some benefits, and you know, as far as charting, I would think that besides your serve, you would chart, you know, you chart your unforced errors, but also chart, you know, would be charting your opponent, what your opponent did to you, be important? You know, would that be something
that would be one of the things that you could chart. You could definitely chart your opponent, like as far as, you know, are you looking for Chris Bowder, the one of the coaches that works under Judy Murray in Scotland. He had a great thing that I love that I have a copy of here in my house that goes over the you know, shoulda, woulda, coulda aspect of a thing, you know, that, you know, in terms of shot selection, which is really a great learning thing. And I look at that and I go, oh wow. And you know, as far as learning to make the decision making process. You know, did they go for the right shot? Should they have gone for that shot? Could they have gone for it, but they didn't? And I mean, there's lots of different charting things. It all depends on what information, what have you been working on in training and practice, and what data that you want. You know, are you reaching those goals? Or are you not reaching those goals? And that's really up to the coach in terms of what. But if parents want to, whether they want to contact me or the people that I mentioned, they've all got really good chart things, and I've got different ones for different things.
Now, question: you know, Susan, you have a similar background. You've got background in basketball. You know, in basketball, your stats, you could have consequences in practice of stats. You know, you had a game, and you lost the game, and you got four rebounds. Well, you're supposed to miss, you missed that. Would you set consequences for these stats that the parents gave you back as to your players? I see that a lot of coaches, a lot of tennis coaches, they frown on consequences and physical consequences like laps and different things. So I tend to think that's just part of the development. Would you personally have consequences to some of these laps where if a child served 45% on their first serve when you know you just worked 2 weeks on the first serve, would there be consequences on that? Because to me that would sound like lack of focus or lack of adjustment or lack of something. Would there be consequences? You know, would you?
It depends on the player. And some players respond really well to that and some players don't. And I think it's partly you got to know your players. I mean, when I played basketball, yes, we had it. Matter of fact, my high school coach, Sam Terry, he used to put X's and O's on the ball. And at any time in practice, we used to have to identify if the ball was X or an O because he wanted to see how sharp and how focused we were. You know, because that would be the thing. Because are you really focused on what you're doing? You know, well, I want you focused. I want you there mentally on the court. And if we got it wrong, I mean, yeah, we did push-ups or we had this thing with me one day about hitting balls into the net. And for every ball I hit into the net, I had to do 10 push-ups. And all I can tell you is it took me a week to do the, you know, 700-plus push-ups. I learned a vertical game.
But you learn, but you don't miss into the net. If you miss, you miss long. Am I right or wrong?
I miss long or I miss wide. You know, I can do push-ups like nobody's business, and I think after doing 700, I learned that I didn't like doing push-ups as much, but. You know, and it wasn't, I didn't look at it as punishment as I looked at it as the lesson of up. And after that, he did the classic, he had a rope over the net, and I had to hit it. You know, and I practiced that until I had it mastered. I could be able to put spin on the ball, you know, enough to bring the ball down and support. So,
that's a question. What do you think about this is just off of my head, just something I meant to ask you before. Do you think most men coaches, when they're dealing with young girls as students, are too easy on them, too hard on them.
I think a lot of times they're one of the two extremes. And to be honest with you, I've seen the extremes of both. Very rarely do I see somebody that gets it right. And I think, you know, it's so funny to me because as coaches, we focus so much on the nuts and bolts on, you know, are we going to hit an open stance or a semi-open or a closed stance? Are we going to, you know, one of the things we really need to talk about is how effective are we at communicating? And I mean, that's one of the things that I loved about Coach Wood is that he hounded to me all the time about being very clear and concise with what I was saying. And I can tell you that was probably some of the best lessons that I ever learned. And am I always perfect? Oh, no. But I strive to be as good as I can possibly be to bring out the best in my players. So I was working with a girl tonight in Beaumont on her serve, and, you know, she would green ball hit, and she'd come up and, you know, she'd turn her hand up and, you know, it looked like a cocktail waitress or a waitress and come up. And it was the first opportunity that I've ever had to really work with her and to fix it. And I played her, you know, and I got it fixed in about 20 minutes. And it was really understanding how to communicate and how to be really effective with it. So I think that's one of the things that a lot of men coaches miss with girls is that they are a little bit more difficult at times to communicate with because some of them can be so bloody sensitive. And I'm being honest, and I'm a girl saying it, and they can be really sensitive.
I understand. Well, Susan, you know, we've had a good little short show tonight. Today, I know you're busy. We've had a good short show today, and we talked about some things that, you know, are just real life little incidents that go on in tennis. You know, and I thought that you gave some great points. You know, and the fact of being a parent and being a coach. I find a lot of stuff that you said to be very, very, very interesting. Very interesting. One thing I want to know, Susan, who's better, you or Chuck Tomlin?
As far as what?
One-on-one, who would win? Battle of the Sexes, you and Chuck Tomlin.
Oh, Chuck would probably win because of his serve, because I really can't physically, my shoulder's too bad anymore to serve. I volley better than he does.
Who would win, me or you?
Oh, you would.
I mean,
you all have bigger serves than I do. I can't serve right now. I'm serious. I mean, I can sit here and I'm outside of my car now. I can sit here and I can go through the motion, but, you know, anytime I crank it up, I pay a huge price for about 2 or 3 weeks. So, you know, I go out and play pretty. And look, and have beautiful strokes, but if I try to all my serve, put any mustard on it at all, it's ugly for a couple of days. So I don't even pretend to do that anymore. You know, I was up at the net volleying with Russell with my girl today, and you know I could hang there and volley, and I can return and I can hit ground strokes, but if I have to really serve, it's over with in about 15 minutes. About 15 minutes of it is about all I can take.
Seriously,
it's about all I can take. So, I mean, you know, I can still move. I can still run down things, and I still have good touch. But, you know, I thought you were going to ask me who teaches what better with Chuck and I was going to tell you. I was going to be very honest.
No, we'll hit that one next time. I wanted to have a little bit of fun. Well, Susan, I wanted to close tonight. I wanted to be a nice short show. But I do want to remind people. I want to remind coaches that, you know, what our topics are for winning these great books, winning Frank Tennis Parents Bible Second Edition. Topic is children performance anxiety. I want the coaches and members. I want to see a post or an essay or something that hits the topic. How do we cure performance anxiety? And if there's a post, if that post gets more than 100 likes, Frank has sent us an autographed copy of Raising an Athletic Royalty. This is a great book. Susan stands by this book. I haven't had a chance to read this one yet, but I read the Bible. I read the Bible first edition, and now I'm on the second edition, and I can tell you that's a great, great read. And
it's great book.
Susan says this, and Frank is, we're going to also be hitting, while we're doing the contest, we're going to be also doing some inserts from the book. Frank has given us permission to do some quotes from the book with some conversations and some quotes, and until we lead up to the contest. And I guess we're going to have the contest in on a, let's give, what do we want to give everybody? So maybe February the 15th? You want to give them February 15th, or you want to say a little, maybe February 12th, 10th? What date? What's a good date? How long do these think the coaches need, Susan?
I think they can do it in a week. So I think maybe a week from now, start it tomorrow morning, put it out there, and we'll start tomorrow morning as the date and give them a week.
Okay, that sounds good. All right, so from a week from today, we'll be announcing the winner on this show. And Frank has given us, like I said, you're winning an autographed copy. Not everybody has, you might have a copy, but you don't have an autographed copy. And this
now,
is an autographed
I've got a
copy.
Question. With this autographed copy, does he send a box of Krispy Kreme donuts? Because, you know, Frank is a big fan of Krispy Kreme. And anybody that follows his stuff knows that when he was at one of his locations, he would claim he was using their Wi-Fi, but we all know better that he was really hanging out at Krispy Kreme.
I think
he needs to add some Krispy Kremes in there.
I'm gonna send him a text as soon as we get off here about the Krispy Kreme. Hey, I'm gonna send him a text about them Krispy Kremes because I know he might be in the men that wear plaid group. You know, he looks like a man that'll wear plaid. You know, he does look like a man that'll wear plaid.
You know what? All real men, you know, will wear plaid shorts on the tennis court. Matter of fact, kudos to you because when I was in Atlanta and you came to see me, I have photographic proof that you came to see me and you were wearing plaid shorts.
Yes, I was. Yes, I was. I know you're plaid. And you see my man Ken Surely in the plaid shirt the other day looking dapper. You know, I was like, if I didn't know he was happily married, I'd be like, what are you profiling for date.com? Looking good.
And you know, my good friend Scott up north from me, you know, he is like, no, Susan, I'm disappointed because real men wear plaid shirts and plaid shorts. And, you know, thank God all these guys are married because I would be in trouble. And there would be a lot of trouble. I mean, even Dave Smith, you know, has sent me a picture of him in plaid shorts. So what can I say?
What can you say? Well, Susan, I want to thank you for another great show with some great information. And I look forward to talking to you Sunday where we'll have our surprise guest. It may even be Frank himself. I don't know. I do know he's scheduled to come here one day, but it may be Coach Dawoo. You know, hey, you know, we some good fireworks. That would be a great show. That would be a great one. It may be a show that I would love to hear. This is my fantasy show. I dream every night. You and Coach Stone. Oh, that would be a wonderful show. You're Sarah Stone. I'm praying that we can get our schedule together for that one because that is going to be a two popcorn bag show for me. That's going to be a two popcorn bag show for me.
Yeah, I know. She is an awesome person. I just love her to death. She's awesome.
Susan, take us out of here, and I'll talk to you later.
All right, Wes, it's good to talk to you. Stay safe and warm in Atlanta, and I'll talk to you here real soon, hopefully Sunday night.
Yes, we'll be there Sunday night, Susan. I want to thank everybody. Susan, I'll talk to you Sunday. Good night.
All right, good night. Take care, hon. All right, we'll do. Bye.